everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini with the Go See Talk podcast. Thanks for coming back to the show. Today, we're going to have a fun one. We are delighted to speak to director Tim Kirkby about his latest film. We're going to get a first look at Last Looks, and I think this movie starring Mel Gibson is one for the books. So, Tim, thank you so much for being part of the show. How's things in your world?
Very good, thank you. I'm super excited to share Last Looks with the world. It's funny, the writer, Howard Michael Gould, just put a post on his Instagram, and it said, conceived as a TV series in 2010, written as a feature screenplay in 2012, reworked into a novel in 2016, published in 2018, filmed in 2019, and released today in 2022. So what's that? That's 12 years, right? I mean, that's bonkers. But also, as you know, I'm sure you've spoken to a few people, it's very hard putting a film together and getting it made. And there's many pitfalls and many challenges along the way, and people come and go, and you attach and detach. And so, yeah, I sort of stand up and applaud this film finally going out. I mean, I'm really excited, and just I hope people kind of enjoy it.
Well, I can tell you right off the bat, I enjoyed it. And it's great hearing that sort of backstory, the sort of travelogue of this film's journey. It because, you know, you mentioned in that it was written originally as a TV show. This felt to me like one of my favorite shows, Justified.
Right.
Elmore Leonard and starring Timothy Oliphant. But it's so interesting that you have to almost, you know, take something to a different medium, or I mean, it's almost the effect of, well, hey, I'm going to take this, turn it to a kid's book, then it gains some popularity with kids, and then ipso facto it becomes, you know, the next thing. That trajectory is phenomenal. When did you get involved, actually?
So I was in Los Angeles editing a studio film in 2018, I think, maybe 2017. And I was, you know, I think as I'm sort of known as a comedy director in television, I get sent a lot of funny scripts. Some of them aren't very good, but there are a lot of kind of hard comedies, and, you know, you have to sort of be careful what you say yes to and attach to, because, you know, you just got to protect your credibility, and, you know, I'm material driven. So I was sort of quite flattered and honored to be sent Last Looks, which was called Waldo when it came to me. And I think it was sent to me because I just had a show out called Brockmire, which had a sort of really kind of gritty sort of feel to it, quite naturalistic and quite silly and funny with sort of some emotion running through it. So so Last Looks was quite a good fit, and I really enjoyed reading the first few pages where very little happened, and you just had this portrait of a man who has sort of long hair, quite sort of feral, living off the land, had 100 things, possessions, and all very still and very eco, and I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the quietness of the way the story was delivered in the first instance, because, you know, as the story progresses and builds up, he gets sort of like, he goes back to the place which he revered, LA, and then the whole film or screenplay sort of turned into this good old fashioned Hollywood kind of murder mystery. And it was fun, and there was a lot of detail on the page, and I loved the screenplay, and it was intriguing, and you saw this character develop, go completely 180. You know, he went from sort of still and quiet to sort of very, he got his mojo back, and he solved this crime. And I just loved the character. I sort of related to that kind of outsider, sort of loner quality, you know, upward punching against all the odds. And it came to me with Charlie Hunnam attached. And I love Charlie. I thought he was really, I think he's, you know, quite very charismatic actor. And so I met up with him and went to a sort of British pub, I think, in LA, which was slightly odd, and had a pint of bitter. And then we just connected. We just bonded and sort of shared our thoughts about the film and wanted to keep it quite faithful and quite honest, and but then push it in certain areas. So I signed on. I was like, yeah, let's do this. Okay. And then inevitably it's just a waiting game to see what happens next. It hadn't any finance at that point. Had a brilliant producer, Andrew Lazar. So he was sort of in the background trying to get interest. And then I think we sent it to Mel Gibson. You may have heard of him. And he read it, and I Zoomed with him, or Skype back in those days.
Yeah, right.
Back in those old fashioned days, we Skyped. And got on, and he's great. And he's just this incredible presence and energy. And we laughed and we shared thoughts about the character. And so once he was on board, then it became a property that could potentially get financed and made. Having said that, it still took a while to get those pieces of the jigsaw together.
Sure. Do you find it more difficult now that, you know, a lot of people have been siloed due to the pandemic? Do you think it's a little more difficult to get the financing when people actually can't get together and you're sort of taking things on faith or Zoom calls, as you said? Is any of that play a factor in the
Yeah, you know? I mean, we're definitely, and it had a huge factor on the sort of on this film going out, really, because you know, the industry is different post pandemic. It's not better and it's not worse. It's just very different. So you have to respond. I mean, look, I like getting in the room with someone. You know, I feel it's a connection on a human level. They can look you in the eye and they I like this person. I want to go into business with a Zoom. It sort of takes that away. So you're looking in the you know, it's just a sort of slightly kind of artificial meeting in a way. And so, you know, and I think with the film as well, like, you know, this film has a couple of sort of flavors to it. It's part comedy, part detective, part noir. And then when the pandemic hit, there was a lot of interest in very, very, very specific genre-led films, because, you know, the all the digital platforms have categories, so it had to fall into a comedy or a sci-fi or horror. And if you had a sort of cross-genre project, it was tricky. So that's what's happened sort of now, is that you have to be very specific about the tone of the film, what the film is about, but sort of where it fits into the market. Whereas, you know, pre-pandemic, you could rock up to the cinema, going to see a romance, and then it might have a bit of horror and it might have a bit of comedy, and then you leave the cinema going, actually, you know, that wasn't what I expected, but I really liked it. Whereas now, if you sit at home, you want a romance, you get the romance. So this was, yeah, a pre-pandemic sort of cross-genre film. And, you know, it's still a murder mystery, there's no doubt about that, and with some comedic moments. But it has those flavours which I enjoy. I want to sort of be entertained on many different sort of levels, really. And it has to feel emotional, it has to mean something, and you have to connect to the lead character. So now when I'm sort of reading scripts, it is a little bit more pigeonholed, which is no problem. That's just the way it is. It's just the way the industry's revealed itself, or rather the market. So yes, in answer to your question, it is slightly different, and you have to adjust, and you have to, what's interesting about it is all Zooms, and you can Zoom with someone for an hour or two, and then you might get the job. They might go, great, we love this guy, and off we go. Whereas I flew over to LA for one meeting once. CIA were like, they really want to meet you, Tim, on this TV project. So I flew over, got the cheapest flight I could, stayed in some shitty kind of, you know, hotel, went for the meeting, and then flew home. Mm-hmm. And all that's gone. That sort of slightly kind of maverick sort of, you know, I mean, obviously now it's sort of gradually getting back together, but I prefer being in the room. Obviously, you know, you can just feel more relaxed and you can really connect with someone. But it's okay. We're just in a different space now, and things happen a bit quicker, actually, because obviously, you know, you can do 6 or 7 Zooms a day and talk to different people and fix scripts, and that's just the way the industry is right now. But so, you know, gone are the sort of the premieres, you know, obviously for the really sort of for the big films, but these little films that come out, it's very much sort of released. But that's fine. Yeah, again, that's fine. I'm just excited that it's out there, to be honest with you. I really am. It's been a long time coming, and you just want to, you know, it's sort of, you just want people to see it and talk about it. And if someone says they loved it, then that makes me feel great.
Absolutely. And, you know, that brings up a good point. You know, being both a consumer and a journalist, I do miss that sort of interaction between talent and press. And, you know, when you do have to be on the road and try to sell something, it's that sort of grassroots campaign, whether it's a small film or a blockbuster. And I kind of miss that. Miss going to theaters, and I could just imagine what the creative process is like when you can't be, you know, sitting with Lynn Falconer to talk about the wardrobe or talking to your production designer. Yeah. And so kind of on that note, a couple things that I really gleaned from the movie that made me smile were those tangible elements, like there's a portrait of Mel Gibson in a hunting coat. So that's a prop that needs.
I've got a very funny, very funny story about that. So yeah, so I wanted like a few memorabilia around his sort of his mansion, which was this, which is, I think it's the biggest house in Georgia. I think Tyler Perry built it, or he lived there. Then he moved out, and I think there's a sort of an evangelist living there now. But anyway, so he used it for Arthur Pinch's sort of mansion, and I just wanted those slightly kind of cheesy, you know, kitsch props around the house. So I said to the artist, I said, I know this sounds weird, but can you sort of paint it badly? Like a sort of, like a sort of rubbish version of Mel Gibson in hunting gear. And that's what came back. And I just burst out laughing because it's not very good. And Mel found it funny, and he came and said, what's that? And I said, oh, you know, it's just a bit of fun. And he found that funny anyway. The amusing part of the story is that on the last, his last scene, we did a big scene in the trailer. We were in there for hours. Then we just stepped out of the trailer, and all the crew were there to wish him on his merry way. And we had this portrait framed properly. It's a horrible thing. And sort of gave it to him as a wrap present. And he was sort of, he just, all the colour went in his face because it was just like, oh right, he's got to pretend to say sort of thank you. He's got to take this thing back to LA, and I'm sure it just found like a dumpster around the corner and just threw it away. But yeah, but you know,
the story will live on. The story will live on. So thanks for sharing that.
I know. And the designer, Jeremy, was extraordinary, and we looked at a lot of different references. I think the key for me and him was to try and capture LA, because there's, you know, I said somewhere in one of my little press releases that LA is a city of doors. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of the time in LA is spent in rooms, and you just have an address, and you go there and you open the door and there's a beautiful bar or restaurant, and you think, wow, I had no idea this place was behind this little door. And so that was the kind of trick, really, which is to make each interior quite moody, quite atmospheric, quite dangerous, quite edgy, but change each one so that he is sort of in this sort of very claustrophobic internal world. And we only shot one day in Los Angeles just to get some exteriors, but that was the challenge for the designer and myself. Because it was, you know, he had to try and capture that. And for Sikorsky's office, in the end, we just couldn't find the right location. So we actually used the unit base, which was this miserable sort of rundown office somewhere in Atlanta. And I found this brilliant reference of Robert Evans' office from the 70s with all these black and white pictures behind him. And I said, let's do that. Let's just plaster the wall with all these, you know, these black and white photos of icons. So we did it. And then in the post-production, just managed to pop on a photo of Mel as a sort of, I think it's from the Mutiny, Mutiny on the Bounty. They just put it there in the back of shot and it worked really well. But yeah, there's a great iconic photo of Robert Evans sitting in his office with his feet on the table on this old-fashioned phone and all these, this huge wall of photos. So that was the look that I was going for. I just wanted to play with, you know, because an office is an office and you think, I just don't like doing obvious, sort of boring things. I try to put something interesting into every element of the scene. And you've seen all these modern offices. I thought, actually, you know, forget that. Like, I just want the actor to walk in and smile and go, this is great, you know, let's feed off this. And so sort of, yeah, there's a sort of, I mean, I don't think, you know, Black Bear Studios, which is the studio that Alistair Pinch works for, I don't think their offices are like that at all, but I just wanted to do something visual.
Well, adapting the film from a TV show to a novel, and so following that pathway, injecting it in America, but giving it almost a British sensibility. Is that something that you kind of helped craft along the way, or was it Charlie's involvement? Because what I'm asking about that is it feels like Chinatown, which was in a way replicated with Big Lebowski, and detective movies have, you know, some sort of like a detective through line, but there's a lot of humor in this that feels British at times. So yeah. Was that intended? How did that come about? Or am I maybe just making that up?
No, not at all. I mean, you make a good point. And, you know, I think sort of the British and American comedy, there is a crossover. And, you know, the Brits are quite good at sort of disciplining the comedy, sort of, and Americans will sort of extend sort of comedic moments. And that's, you know, that's interesting because obviously Charlie's a Brit. So there's things that he and I would find funny. And we did, I think it's a tiny little scene where towards the end of the film, where he asked the receptionist at the kindergarten school for a list. And she gives them this folder and he coughs and rips out a page as he coughs. That's a very sort of British kind of Basil Fawlty type moment. Mm. So yeah, you know. But the thing is, what I like, as your good self just did there, Americans like British sort of humour and vice versa. So yeah, it was important to inject as much as I could without sort of overpowering it. I mean, the Lebowski's a different type of film. It's very much positioned as a comedy, and it's sort of, you know, he's this kind of stoner character and he's sort of drifting through, whereas this is a bit more sort of serious. It has a kind of slightly more kind of pain underneath it. So I think if you put too much comedy onto it, then it becomes sort of slightly unbelievable. So I put a lot of the comedy into the costume, into some of the performances, and tried to surround this very sort of myopic lead character with different flavors of actors. Like, there's a great actor, one of my favorite actors is David Pasquese, and I met him in Veep, and he's brilliant. He plays Julia Louis Dreyfus's husband in it, and he's just extraordinary. I think he's a stand-up as well, and just amazing. And on page, the part was good, but it didn't have anything to it. It sort of had it just needed someone like him to walk in, do the thing that David Pasquese does. And Charlie loved that because it was a very different type of actor that he was used to. And it was really important for me to put these comedy actors as well as very dramatic actors around him to because that's my experience of Los Angeles, is when you walk in, you feel, you kind of meet different people and you have to adjust to that person. So the comedy is sort of, it's there and it's not. And I was just very conscious that when we did a scene, you really want to nail the heart of the scene and the point of the scene. And it's like, right, we've got that. Let's think about it. Let's skew it slightly and put a comedic slant onto it. And so we all kind of worked together and figured some stuff out. So, you know, and Mel's great at that. He's really up for sort of playing. You can get him to say any line. And he was really into the some of the Englishisms and he would surprise me with his knowledge of obscure Cockney terms. I think he hugs Waldo at the end. He goes, "Come here, my old cockalorum," which is a very old term that you just wouldn't hear. But he knows quite a lot of. He just knows everything. It seems to be Melopedia.
That's a good way to phrase it. Well, you know, I like Charlie's role in Green Street Elite, or as it's called in America, Green Street Hooligans, where he has a small exchange with Elijah Wood, and he goes, "It's not," he goes, "No, mate, it's football. It's not soccer." I love the way Charlie just enunciates. But you know, Mel, like the two ones that really grabbed my attention were the part where Charlie's kind of observing the photograph of the house in Town and Hearth, or Town and Wanker, that as Mel said, and then he pops up because Charlie's trying to discern the differences between the setting, and then when he throws the glass over his shoulder and he's about to get arrested, and so
thanks for picking those out, because they're film risks, I call them, where you just you get the scene, like I said, and then you try stuff. And Mel said, "I want to," he wanted to throw the glass, and I was like, "Great, I love that, please." So that was his idea. The popping up from the magazine was my idea. But again, they're both like, "Yeah, great, let's do this." And then, you know, but some actors will question that. It's like, why am I popping up from there? And I haven't really got time to come in the room. And you have to sort of go through this kind of annoying conversation about, you know, and by the time you've had this conversation, it's like, well, why don't we just shoot it instead of talking about it? Let's just shoot it. But both Charlie and Mel were just like, "Great, let's try it." And they try stuff. And so you do it. And then Town and Wanker Magazine, I think it was one of mine, actually, because it was Town and Country. And actually, you know what? It might have been one of his. I can't remember. But wanker is a very underused word in America. I just don't even know if Americans really know what it means. But it's a very, very British word. I always remember when in an episode of Miami Vice in the 80s, there's an episode where Phil Collins is in the episode and he's playing Phil Collins. And then he says to Don Johnson, "You must take me for a right wanker." And it's really controversial then. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't heard it since then. And Mel said it in Last Look. So I was very pleased.
That's great. Well, it's funny, as I kind of grew up on British humor and a lot of British films, and there's sort of a connection here. So Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, they have a poker match that's set up to ruin one of the boys. And one of the men comes out and gets his, you know, he gets kicked out because he loses his money, and he just stands out and he goes, "Wanker, wanker." So that first became part of my vernacular. But I think that American audiences, because of the success of Ted Lasso, a lot like the shirt I'm wearing now, they were not taking too well to the American football coach coming to play their teach their football, and he was called Wanker throughout the entire, you know, first season.
Yeah, it's great. I think when swear words are used well, that they're really powerful in film. You know, I think Larry David says a couple in Curb, and when he does, you know, it's just jaw dropping. But when it's overused, it loses its presence. But So you've got to be quite sort of mindful about how and when to do it. There's a great moment in Waldo, actually, where I didn't know Charlie was going to do this, where it was a fight scene. He just learned of the death of Morena. So he's really wound up. And then he sees Don Q in the kindergarten car park. And I like to film the rehearsal. I just think, there's something very spontaneous and instinctive about that first take. And you don't want to be wasting it on a rehearsal. I mean, you can do a blocking rehearsal and just go, right, I'm going to stand here and do that, just so that the cameraman camera person can get the marks. But I like to sort of get that first performance rehearsal in the can. And I think it was that take that, I won't say it now because it's the F word, but he walks and goes, hey, F face. And he slams his bag down. And there's children around, like, and Charlie just came up with that. But it's so sort of, it really gets you because it's sort of funny, but also it's this man who's lost control and anything came out of his mouth at that point. So that's a good use, you know, of language. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think to round this interview out, one of the, you know, you mentioned the pace of the film was purposely slow. And, you know, you don't usually get that these days because short attention span theater and people kind of want to, you know, get to the action. So it's nice that for a detective movie, it's par for the course, but there's editing truly helps the film in its slow moments. It helps it in its comedic moments. But I think there's something that you did that rewards the audiences for paying attention. You know, the idea of 100 items that Waldo adopts, and he's very purposeful about keeping those. So there's that funny exchange between the Kindle and the note, Nook, and he's down to 99. And it's like the editing is so quick that he goes into that store, the gun store, comes out, and he just says 100. And I think that if it's like a blink and you miss it moment, but I think it ties the narrative together. And it's just an example of sort of the sophistication of the film. I just wanted to thank you. I noticed that was very well done.
That's brilliant. Thanks for pointing that out. It's great. I mean, Joe Lendow did a brilliant job editing, and we just kept combing the film to make sure that we were looking after, you know, the 100 items thing. I mean, I had a big sort of debate with him about that bit. Is one bullet one item? You know what I mean? So six bullets and a gun, is that seven items? Or the gun, do you know? So we had these sort of these conversations, but yeah, just wanted to slip that in. Wanted to keep that storyline alive about the 100 items, which I think is quite fun. That's something Howard was keen to do. But yeah, you know, it has an interesting pace because I wanted to save the title sequence and save the chaos. It's quite old fashioned in that regard. It has a sort of, you know, it harks back to sort of going to the cinema and watching the film and getting drawn into it. So it's a bit of a risk because obviously people consume cinema differently now. And you sit down, you put the TV on and you choose a film and you watch it, and you've got to get that audience hooked. Otherwise you've had it. But I knew that having Mel Gibson in it first couple of minutes, or a flavor of him, Clancy Brown turns up very, very early. People love Clancy. So there's hopefully enough to sort of get to the fast paced stuff. Because I think once you hit that, then the film doesn't let up. And the editing goes fast and the music's fast and Waldo's performance is different. So I just wanted to do that. And then, you know, after the scene at the end, I wanted to distill it where he has a conversation with Don Q, which you don't see a lot in films because that scene would have been cut out for pace. But I just thought, no, put it in there because, you know, why not? After all this, it reminds me of, remember The Thing, John Carpenter's Thing?
Oh, where, love that one, yeah.
Where at the end, they're just sitting round, aren't they? And they're just having a conversation. And so you have to go into that quiet place after full-on chaos is really lovely, that contrast.
Well, Tim, thank you for explaining that. Thank you for spending some time with us. Last My Looks pleasure. Comes out from RLJE Films in theaters and on demand and digital February 4th. Check out Last Looks. Tim, thank you immensely for your enthusiasm, spending some time and sharing some stories. And we will catch you next time.